Greetings, podcast listeners, and welcome to the October edition of the Collabutt Review podcast. My name's Daniel Schoening. As the next installment in our deep dive in the various genres that make up the review, we will cover in this episode creative nonfiction. Joining us today is Stephanie Geschwind, director for the Center for Literary Publishing, editor-in-chief and nonfiction editor at Collabutt Review. Thanks for joining us, Stephanie.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us is Harrison Candelaria Fletcher, nonfiction editor at Collabutt Review, contributing editor at Speculative Nonfiction, associate professor at CSU, and core faculty at the Vermont College for Fine Arts. Thanks for joining us, Harrison.
Thank you, Danny. Happy to be here.
So to begin today, as part of our series interviewing editors and those responsible for the curating and making of the Collabutt Review, I want to get a little bit into the backgrounds of you two. So Stephanie, I was wondering, obviously now you're editor-in-chief of Collabutt Review, how did you get your start in editing? How did you get your start at the Center for Literary Publishing?
Well, I got 2 degrees in English, both of them here at Colorado State University, and I think when I became an English major, I was originally thinking that I would teach, and I think I was probably thinking of high school, and I figured out pretty quickly that it was really more that I was interested in being a student than interested in being a teacher. And so at some point I started saying, when people would ask me what I was going to do with that degree, that I was going to be an editor. Mm-hmm. And looking back, I see now that there was very little intention behind that. I didn't do any of the things that one would expect someone to do who wants to be an editor. I didn't do any internships. I didn't try to find any jobs. I just kept saying this. And I remember that there was an image in my head of somebody sitting at a desk with some books. That's as far as I understood what editing involved.
Yeah.
So when I finished my graduate program here, I very coincidentally took a temp job that landed me at a publishing company in Loveland for 2 or 3 weeks. And my job was to keyboard manuscripts into one of those little tiny Mac computers. Mm-hmm. Because at the time, and this was 1992, not a lot of authors had computers, and they were still using typewriters and turning their books into their publishers, you know, it's manuscript form. So my job was to type them. And over the course of time, while I was doing this temp job, the people in the book department took me under their wing and had me eat lunch with them. And then soon enough, there was a job available as a copy editor. And I applied for it. And so that I started as a copy editor at a publishing company that did curriculum and games and crafts and that sort of thing. I did that for a couple of years. And then my husband and I moved to Bloomington, Indiana, so he could do his doctorate. And I took a job at Indiana University Press. I had hoped to be a copy editor. That's what I thought of myself as. And there were no jobs as copy editors open except for freelancers. So I was freelancing for them. And eventually a position opened up in the production department. And so I took that, and I did that for 4 years. And I was working on getting jobs to and from the printer, and, you know, it was a lot of clerical stuff, but I learned a lot. I learned how books were made, which I really didn't know. And so after 4 years in Bloomington, we came back to Fort Collins. My husband took a position in the communication studies department here at CSU, and so I had to find a job. And the position for the managing editor at Colorado Review was open. And I got that job. David Malofsky hired me to be the managing editor, even though I knew next to nothing about literary journals. I do want to say, I had taken, as an undergrad and a grad student, I had taken John Calderazzo's creative nonfiction workshop 3 times. So I was very familiar with the genre, but I really didn't know a lot about journals. But I knew how to make a book. So that's how I got into it. I said I was going to be an editor. I didn't really mean it, but then I became an editor.
Yeah. Oh, how funny. And back in Colorado, back at CSU.
And back in, yeah, we, you know, I didn't realize how much I would miss Colorado when I left it, but almost as soon as we got to Bloomington, I was desperate to get back to Colorado, and I never dreamed we would be back in Colorado, let alone in Fort Collins.
Yeah.
So it's been a wonderful journey.
And you've been here for now many years since.
I've been here for 21 years.
21 mm-hmm. years.
So 5 is the managing editor mm-hmm. and 16 is the director.
And in that time, the Center for Literary Publishing and Colorado Review must have fundamentally changed. Can you speak a little bit to those changes?
Well, the internship has grown. Mm-hmm. I was looking this morning at the numbers back in the beginning, and you know, they would always fluctuate and they continue to fluctuate, but essentially we've got about twice the number of graduate students serving as interns here.
Wow.
As in the beginning. We instituted the Nelligan Prize for Short Fiction, and mm-hmm. that was largely at the encouragement of Stephen Schwartz, who funded and continues to fund the honorarium every year. And that's
wow.
That's in memory of Liza Nelligan, who was a graduate student here at CSU when I was a graduate student. And she mm-hmm. became friends with Stephen Schwartz and several of the other faculty members. And unfortunately, she passed away in 2003 from breast cancer. And mm. this was Stephen and his wife Emily's way of honoring her memory. Liza went on to get her PhD in English literature and then began working as an editor for fiction. She was the editor for some of Jennifer Weiner's novels, for example.
Wow.
So it is a way to honor her memory, and we're very proud of that. I started the Mountain West Poetry Series mm-hmm. in 2011 with NEA funding. So we're now on our 17th title.
Wow.
And we started this podcast.
Yeah.
So a lot has changed, but I think the overall spirit and intention of the center is the same.
Mm-hmm.
We've just found new ways to express our values and our interests.
And within those varied values and interests being applied in such a wonderful array of books and projects and elements that are for us as graduate students to learn about the field, is there anything that stands out that you are most proud of, most excited by as you continue to work on and develop?
Well, it's a kind of a non-answer in a way. I'm proud of it all, truly. Mm-hmm. But I think that I'm most proud of the internship.
Yeah.
I love publishing the magazine and the books, and it makes me so happy to see our authors go on to publish books that include pieces that were first published in Colorado Review. I love to see them go on to win prizes, but it also makes me so, so happy to see you, interns,
mm-hmm.
learn things here and go out into the world and practice them, your own writing. So you're here learning how a literary journal works, and it's giving you courage and you know, insight information about how to professionally submit your own work.
Yeah.
But I see you using these skills, copy editing, typesetting, designing, proofreading, publication management, and getting jobs. And that just makes me so happy to see people leave here with something that they love and something that will pay their rent.
Yeah. Both of which yeah. we're steadily learning are more and more important.
Right.
Oh, thank you so much, Stephanie. As ever at Colorado Review, we have lots going on in addition to this podcast. The Center for Literary Publishing is pleased to announce that Brandon Krieg's Magnifier, chosen by Kazem Ali as the winner of the 2019 Colorado Prize for Poetry, is now available at the Colorado Review website under the Bookstore tab. Also there, listeners can find past winners of the Colorado Prize for Poetry, including The Owl Was a Baker's Daughter by Gillian Cummings, and selections from our Mountain West Poetry Series, including Adam Fagan's Furthest Ecology. Those chomping at the bit for the next issue of Colorado Review can expect the fall-winter edition to come out this November. In the meantime, be sure to track down the latest issue from summer of 2019, available in that same bookstore tab. To ensure that you're up to date with all the wonderful things going on here at the Center for Literary Publishing and Call It a Review, be sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter and Instagram. Now, Harrison, a bit about your beginnings. For those that might not know, before you entered academia and creative nonfiction, you worked for years in journalism. I was hoping that you would speak to your trajectory from that field into this one, how you ended up here, and what you feel like is the texture of the difference between journalism and CNF.
Sure, absolutely. Thank you, Danny. I will start a little even before journalism.
Please.
All roads for me lead back to New Mexico. My childhood growing up there, I had an unconventional childhood of raised by a single mom, mm-hmm. not a lot of money. So what we did do was drive into the desert, into the landscape. And she was an artist, so she collected artifacts and images and would come back to our house and assemble mosaics or collages. Mm. And but everywhere we went, we collected stories. Mm. We spent our days, our afternoons talking to people, old people, owners of junk shops, trading posts. So at a very early age, I got addicted to the power of story. Hmm. And listening to the way people talk and the way they express themselves. And when I got out of college, I was 2 years as a visual artist in undergrad school. But when I got out, I figured I needed a job. My sister was a journalist and suggested that I give that a try. Hmm. And it seemed to be a continuation of what we did when I was a kid, which was going out, exploring, and talking to people, mm-hmm. and learning how to tell stories and communicate stories. Mm. So I did that. I was in my journalism background, everything from a cops and robbers reporter. I covered the prisons in New Mexico. I became a columnist. Mm-hmm. I was an editorial writer. I wrote narrative nonfiction. So I kind of covered the gamut in the journalism world, all the, you know, learning how to write narrative, learning how to, you know, pay attention to detail, all those things that that make story, and also being around the publishing world, mm-hmm. hanging around editors, working very closely with editors, got addicted to that world. And I was a columnist when I started my MFA program. I had wanted to take my work a little more from the exterior world to the interior world, mm-hmm. to use myself more as a lens for storytelling, and discover the personal essay.
Yeah.
And never went back, I guess, so to speak. So it's been a growth from the external world, gathering stories, the personal essay, going interior, and now I'm trying to combine my visual art background with my writing background and make my own language, so to speak.
Yeah. And so, do you feel, or rather, do you still employ those mechanisms that you learned so early on in your career in journalism in your current writing or in your stint here at the Center for Literary Publishing?
Absolutely. I learned a ton about creative writing from journalism. Mm. Attention to detail, listening to people, structure, obviously nonfiction, mm-hmm. Rooted in the factual experience. All of those things inform some of the experimental work I do now. Yes, it's all, a lot of it is rooted in the fact gathering, direct experience process.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Now, as a current editor in creative nonfiction at Call It a Review, and as a contributing editor at Speculative Nonfiction, can you speak a little bit more about your experience in the field as an editor?
Sure. Thanks, Danny. As I said, I've been around journalism all my life and exposed the production elements, everything from gathering the information, to copying the information, to laying out the information, to seeing it unroll on the printing press. So I've been around that experience all my life. But in my MFA program, I also started off as a contributing or an editor at Hunger Mountain for a while. Then I became a nonfiction editor for a magazine called Upstreet, mm-hmm. which is a Vermont-based magazine too. And in 2006, I started my own magazine, my own literary journal, kind of like my own indie rock label. It was called Shadowbox, and it was inspired by the work of Joseph Cornell.
Yeah, of course.
And that was the vision, was to gather disparate types of nonfiction and display them or curate them issue to issue. And at the time, there wasn't a lot of venues for nonfiction work that was looking forward, you know, short form work, lyric essay work, video essay. There just wasn't a lot of venues. And a friend of mine at CU, we started a digital magazine, Shadowbox, and ran that for 6 years. It was a lot of fun. I did everything from laying it out to advertising to copy editing and did the whole thing. And it was a lot of fun. Learned a lot about a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And after that, I was advising editor for Blackbird over at VCU. Mm-hmm. And most recently been to join the team, Robin Hemley and Lila Phillips' new venture, Speculative Nonfiction, is one of the contributing editors. So. Mm-hmm. Again, it all goes back to the beginning of those New Mexico days of helping to give voice to experiences in different ways, different approaches. And for me, that's still a passion of mine.
And as a reader of Colorado Review, I can feel that ethic and intention in the works that we curate and the voices we choose to elevate. Now, to get into the nitty-gritty of creative nonfiction here at Colorado Review and the Center for Literary Publishing, for those that might not be aware, the CLP has published theme nonfiction anthologies, most recently Beautiful Flesh, A Body of Essays, for which you, Stephanie, serve as their editor. How did that collection and those prior come about? What are the joys and trials of editing those sorts of projects?
Well, the first one was Man in the Moon, mm-hmm. Essays on Fathers and Fatherhood. And that arose, well, really it started, I think, when I noticed some of the anthologies that Hattie Fletcher and Lee Gutkind were putting out from their press at Creative Nonfiction. And I remember thinking one day, I wish I could do that. That looks like a lot of fun. And then it occurred to me, I can do that. I'm allowed to do that. Do I know how to do that? I think I know how to do that. And I talked to Hattie about it. And as it so happened, there was AWP in Boston, and there was a panel on putting together anthologies, and I attended it. And I confirmed that I really did know how to do this. It just meant I had to do it. And so the first one was Man in the Moon, and it had come to me slowly over the years. I started noticing that I had published a lot of essays in Colorado Review that were about fathers. So that's one of my obsessions, I guess I would say. And specifically with that one, it was this sense of how does one ever truly get to know one's father? Why does this person seem so unknowable? And we published an essay by Bill Capisseri. It was the first one of his that we ever published called Man in the Moon. He did a series of essays, family memoir essays, that were framed through an astronomy lens. And so in this one, he writes about his relationship with his father and a telescope that his father had given him and then his father's death and, you know, the sense that he was now so far away. And it seemed like the perfect title. It just, it couldn't have been more perfect for this collection. And when I started putting this together, I had published 7 essays in Colorado Review that were about fathers. And so those became the basis of it. And then I collected 12 more, and they were very easy to find. This seems to be not just my obsession, but many people's obsession.
A cultural one.
What is that? It was so much fun, and I'm so proud of that anthology. So I decided I would do another one. And I think that it's a little bit like, I don't have children, but I have heard this many times, that the first baby was so easy and slept through the night as soon as we brought him home from the hospital. And we didn't have to even change his diaper. And that's how the first anthology was. It was so easy. And I thought, well, I'll do another one. I'll do it on bodies. And People write about their bodies all the time. We had a couple of essays that I had published in Colorado Review. One was called Shock to the Heart by Katie Standifer, and it's about her internal cardiac defibrillator, and it's about electricity. And as we had published another one by Matthew Ferentz that was about bones. And I thought, okay, we'll start with these two, and they'll just come to me. And that one was a little harder.
Yeah, a middle child.
It was the second colicky baby who never slept through the night. And I ended up having to delay publication on that by almost a year. It was just harder to find the essays. I think originally I hadn't thought to do what I ended up doing. I think I was originally planning to just publish essays on the body. And then I started with heart and bones. And then I think from there I got a nose and some eyes and a brain. And then that's when it occurred to me, oh, I am building a body.
Yeah.
And I would like these not to be just about the body in general, but about body parts. So my goal and intention shifted somewhat significantly as the anthology was in production. But once I did that, it became harder to find. I mean, certainly people write about their bodies, but it's the common problem we find with even regular submissions, an anecdote versus an essay.
Yeah.
And so certainly people had written very interesting things about their bodies or parts of their bodies, but they didn't really work as essays in at least in how I was imagining the project to go. So that one was just a lot harder. But at any rate, that one went on to win the Colorado Book Award for nonfiction anthology. And I'm very proud of that. The thing about, you asked about the joys and the tribulations. So the joys are many. There's something that is so satisfying about taking things, identifying things that go together and then arranging them and then discovering that you now have something that is so much greater than the sum of its parts. So I had all these individual essays and they became this body, a multi-ethnic, multi-gender, fabulous collection of pieces that became this wonderful body. But the tribulations are a few. And I would say the biggest one is that there's not a great market for nonfiction anthologies. I love them. I can't believe everybody doesn't want to run out and buy them. But Jane Friedman has a book called The Business of Being a Writer, which is really wonderful. But in it, she talks about anthologies, essay collections. And she says, file these under difficult to publish. And I would say it for me, they're not difficult to publish because I'm doing it. They're difficult to sell. So that's that would be the part that is not so joyful about nonfiction anthologies. But I think I would like to do more of them. I just need to take a break after this. For a little while.
At minimum, to find more organs out in the world.
No, we're done with the body. We've done the body.
Oh, well, that's fantastic. Thank you. Harrison, we spoke earlier about your array of literary pursuits. Have you ever had or do you have an interest in putting together your own anthology?
I do. I have. I've been thinking about an anthology for a while. I'm working on a project, an essay project of my own, exploring in-between spaces, liminalities. I'm half Latinx and have noticed that there are a lot of writers who are working in in-between spaces. If you are biracial, an immigrant, transgender, you tend to see the world in your own way. And these writers are inventing new languages, new ways of seeing, new ways of expressing this. And I'm in the process of putting together an anthology about these in-between spaces, not only writing from their experiences, but it's my theory that if you come from a space like that, it's reflected in how you write. And so in terms of form, in terms of approach. I think it's a really important, for me, as a, if I were to publish this anthology or pitch this anthology, for writers who come from in-between spaces to see themselves in a space where their experience is reflected back in a myriad of ways.
Mm-hmm.
Form, subject, content, all of that. And so that's something I'm assembling now mm-hmm. as I write my own project.
How exciting.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Mm-hmm. Stephanie spoke earlier about the difference between an anecdote and an essay. And I think now it feels like a good transition point into this question of what you two, as nonfiction editors at Colorado Review, once something has made it through the queue, has experienced other readers that have said, yes, this is something I want to consider for our magazine, what you're looking for to either sign off on it and say, yes, it's going to enter this next edition, or no, it's not quite right for us. What's that texture? What is the thing that you're looking for?
I'm looking for it to be about more than one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the problem when it's just an anecdote. It's usually just about that one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And to make it an essay, the writer has to find a way to create that dimension.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking in particular of a couple of essays. One of them we published 2 or 3 years ago by Emily Sinclair called Searching for the Duck Hole. And the anecdote could have been, I have a very difficult relationship with my mother and we really haven't spoken in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been very interesting in and of itself, but it wouldn't have been an essay. And Emily found a way to make it an essay by creating a parallel narrative in which she is remembering and researching this water feature that was near her home in Dallas where she grew up. And she called it a duck hole. And people have probably seen this. It looks like a hole in the water. Mm. And it's actually called a Bellmouth spillway.
Mm.
And I think it controls flood water.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's interrogating what this spillway, what this duck hole was, why it intrigued her so much, what it meant. And then she moves between these sections about her mother and the ways in which they just never quite connect.
Mm-hmm.
And then the sections about the spillway, the duck hole. And it creates this very unexpected dialogue between those two narratives
mm-hmm.
that gives so much more resonance to this relationship, this absence, because that's what the water looks, it really looks like there's an absence in the middle of in the surface there. So it's no longer an anecdote. It's become this whole other thing. I'm thinking too of an essay that, and it's a little bit more than just the anecdote problem,
mm-hmm.
but about 5 years ago, we published an essay by Daniel Sherrill, and it was about high school boys wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
And I always think if someone had asked me at AWP, would you be interested in an essay about high school boys wrestling? I would have said, not when I was in high school, not now, not ever.
Yeah.
No, that sounds like one of the least interesting things in the world to me. But it is such a fabulous essay because it is so much more than when I was in high school, I was on the high school boys wrestling mm-hmm. team. It's about culture. It's about class. It's about the history of wrestling. And it creates this fabulous, very dynamic
mm-hmm.
memoir piece about Daniel Sherrill. And it's rooted in that time of being on the wrestling team.
Mm-hmm.
But it reaches out and does so much more.
Yeah.
So those are the things that I'm looking for. But sometimes we've done essays that are so wonderful that just don't fit into that mold at all. And I'm thinking of Jad Adkins' lyric essay, Ode to Orange, that we did a couple of years ago.
Mm.
And essentially it's about, It's about his father. And if you had to really distill it down, it's about how the color orange reminds him of his father, or his father reminds him of the color orange. But it's this beautiful meditation on his father's work and his role in their family, and the author's love for his father. It's really a very beautiful lyric tribute in the form of nonfiction.
Yeah. Oh, how wonderful. And I think that within lyricism, within the lyric form, there's still, as an adjacent mode, still that question of either something plain is one-dimensional, is what it is, or offers depth, purchase on something deeper, something that's otherwise more difficult to distill or digest or experience as the reader and writer. And Harrison, what do you look for?
This is going to sound maybe a little weird. See if I can gather my thoughts. I'm not looking for anything, and I'm being serious. I have experienced writing and editing a number of forms, but I'm not looking for anything.
Yeah.
But I'm tuned to my response to it. And so I'm willing to try to meet the work where it is. That said, I am most moved by the degree to which the writer is engaged with their material. And for an essay, I don't know how else to say this, but the degree to which they can convey their reaching towards something other than the experience that they're writing about.
Yeah.
So I'm looking to be engaged with their endeavor, however they do it, whether it's a memoir, whether it's research-based, whether it's attentive to form. You know, the vehicle doesn't really matter, but I'm looking for I'm responding to a level of, you know, emotional engagement or intellectual engagement, or sometimes, you know, spiritual engagement. I mean, I want to be moved, and that's what I respond to first. And how they do it, you know, that's where we get into the technical aspects of it. But my first, I pay attention to my first response.
Yeah.
So I'm not looking for any particular subject, any particular approach. I'm just aware of my response to how deeply they're engaged with what they're working with. And I'm most moved by, as Stephanie just said, by work that reaches beyond what the subject matter might at first appear to be.
And in my experience of reading the sorts of things that we publish at Colorado Review, work that not only explores those things, but welcomes the reader to explore alongside the person writing. Those pieces that are inexclusive, that are really welcoming and asking a question that we can be privy to and participatory in answering, whether it is a lyric form, an unconventional form, or a traditional narrative essay.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And speaking on those formal expressions of works, of the variation of modes and concerns that can lend themselves to your reading that might still land in Colorado Review in spite of whatever trends there might be, I was wondering if you could speak to trends in the field. If in the last few years, in your tenure here at Center for Literary Publishing, you've noticed a particular concern, a particular subject, a mode of exploring those subjects that is prevalent, is more and more frequent.
That's an interesting question. I would say the essay's grown quite a bit, in my opinion, in the last 5 years or maybe longer than that. There are some of those controversial writers out there, David Shields, John Nagata, who view the essay as a vehicle of experience. It's an essay as an experience. So whatever techniques, approaches you use are examples of that, essay as an experience. And about 5 years ago, a lot of writers were exploring the lyric essay, using modes of poetry and image to essay, to explore, to endeavor. And now I'm starting to see writers using speculation and almost a return to narrative as a way to you know, as a way to engage with the experience. If, I know I'm speaking abstractly, but I don't know that that nonfiction is driven by trends so much, mm-hmm. or at least the nonfiction that I pay attention to is more. I think there's a more willingness for some writers to use more tools in their toolbox mm-hmm. than there used to be. So you were seeing more writers trying different approaches, different ways into their materials, different ways to essay than you may have 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And that could be everything from using erasure or images or objects. And I don't think that that's so much based on trends so much as mm-hmm. Being allowed to develop their own languages.
Yeah.
To essay, if that makes any sense. So mm-hmm. 5 years ago, I would say most people, a lot of people were trying the lyric essay mode. Now I think people are finding out that, you know, informed imagination, grounded imagination, factual imagination is as valid a tool as mm-hmm. research.
Yeah.
So that's where I see a lot of people pushing at the moment, if mm-hmm. that makes sense.
And trends might be too pejorative a word for me to use in that sense. I think that does feel like an opening up of the craft. And coming from a background of poetry, it feels like there's often a yo-yo effect toward and away from inherited forms and toward and away from more traditional modes of expression, where right now we might be in creative nonfiction moving far away from them to be determined whether it'll proceed or return.
Well, that's what I love about this genre. There's you're only limited by your imagination or by your reaching, by your yearning. That to me determines what tools you're going to use, mm-hmm. what craft elements you're going to use. And it's unlimited. It's always growing because there are always different ways to essay. There are always different ways to explore your experience.
Mm-hmm. And I've long thought of Colorado Review as a laboratory where we are hosting experiments, by which I don't necessarily mean experimental writing, mm-hmm. but we are hosting what people are trying. And so getting to the essay, to essay. Mm-hmm. And we want to host those interesting experiments that people are trying. And we're not looking for one kind of nonfiction, one kind of fiction, one kind of poetry. We want to see what people are trying and what's working.
Yeah.
And I'd have to say, we talk about this in class a lot, something to ask yourself if you're using alternative ways of essaying is how it serves the work. You know, if you are writing in a different form, if you're using a different approach, the reader's going to want to know why. Mm-hmm. And those forms, they work best when they do more than just reflect a sense of confusion or fragmentation, but enact the experience that you're trying to understand. Mm-hmm. So for me, when I do encounter some work that is using form or using approach in a different way, I ask myself, how is it serving the work? How is it serving the essay? Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important for writers to ask after they've written their piece, is how form and content are working as one.
Yeah.
5 years ago, because it was different, might have been enough to get you published. But now, because there is more of that type of work out there, editors are asking themselves a little bit more discriminatingly, I guess, how is this working? Why is this working in a way that they may not have 10 years ago when it was new and different and exciting?
Yeah, like, why is this essay in the form of a crossword puzzle?
Yeah.
When it's about your grandmother?
Yeah.
Well, and maybe that's the answer.
Yeah.
But,
or how is the crossword puzzle allowing you to understand something about mm-hmm. your grandmother?
And this is an ideal segue into our final question, which is, for those listening, you just spoke a great deal about what it is you do look for or mm-hmm. the absence of what you look for. What advice do you have for those that might have a manuscript, an essay sitting on their shelf right now that they're planning to put in our queue? You just spoke a little bit about their adherence to form and justifying that form in their own work. That's wonderful advice. What else, if you were the one submitting, would you want to make sure you fulfill?
This may be advice that is better suited for someone who doesn't necessarily have that essay ready to go. Maybe this is someone who's tried a couple of essays, but I would say that, and it's not new advice, but you have to do the work.
Yeah.
And in my mind, that involves three things. First, and this is true of across the genres, but since we're talking about nonfiction today, we'll just say nonfiction. So first of all, somebody has to be reading creative nonfiction, and lots of it. You're reading it in lit mags. You're reading it in Best American Essays or anthologies. You are reading it in single author essay collections, Notes from a from No Man's Land, You Feel So Mortal by Peggy Shinner. There are so many wonderful essay collections out there.
Yeah.
But if you want to be writing nonfiction and publishing it, you have to be reading it. You cannot be operating in a vacuum. The second thing that you would be doing is that you're reading about craft. You're reading about creative nonfiction craft. And there are so many fabulous craft books out there. And so I have a stack in front of me, The Far Edges of the Fourth Genre, You Can't Make This Stuff Up, Shadowboxing, Blurring the Boundaries, The Ethics of Life Writing, and The Shell Game. You have to be reading about how this works. And then the third thing is that you are somehow participating in a community where you are giving and receiving feedback. And maybe that's that you're in an MFA program. Maybe you are in a writer's group. Maybe you used to be in an MFA program and that was 10 years ago and now you're communicating with two or three of your peers from that program and you're emailing things back and forth to each other and giving feedback. But I think that someone is doing the work when they're doing these things to some degree or greater at different times in their life. You know, maybe you get to the point where you just have the one person that you're exchanging work with, or you've read most of the craft books. There's a new one that's come out. It's been a couple of years since you've read something, but there's always something that somebody has to say that can just crack things open in a really fabulous, productive way.
So I guess I would say three things. Number one would be to write hard toward what you care about the most. I mean, I think it has to have the passion for the reader to be engaged. And so write hard toward what you would, what you care about most. Second, I think that the first, on a practical level, the first four pages of your essay are crucial because that's where you're teaching the reader how to read your work. Make sure that those elements are there for us to understand what it is you're writing toward. And the last bit of advice I would give is don't give the editors a reason to put it down. And by that I mean grammar, spelling, punctuation, spelling the Colorado Review right. Don't give the editors any reason to put it down, because we have a stack of, or a queue these days, of other essays, and we have a lot of work to do, and we want to be engaged with your work, and we spend time with your work, and we hope that you spend time with your submission. And if it's not in shape, we can tell, and maybe we'll ask you to send it back in the shop if it's not. But yeah, please don't give us any reason to put it down. Don't call us the Sonora Review or the Iowa Review. That happens more than you realize.
It happened yesterday.
And Colorado Review as an institution, as a magazine, is, for my reading and my experience of it, really at the top notch of creative nonfiction, and is now built alongside a program that is nascently exploring creative nonfiction as an MFA. And so those that are going to be reading early in the queue are going to be participants in the Masters of Arts or the Masters of Fine Arts in creative nonfiction. They're going to be engaged readers looking for those things that are most vital, most exciting, writing hard toward the thing that matters most to the person writing. And I think that the experience of reading those in the queue and knowing that something has arrived for us that feels like a gift to be able to experience and to be shared in is so exciting and so enlivening, that I think foremost, I hope that those listening really do decide to submit. creative nonfiction, unlike the other genres that we read for in our general queue, is accepting year-round, unless
right.
I'm mistaken.
No, that's true, because we just don't get enough creative nonfiction. So we keep the door open all year round.
Yeah. And so send your explorations, send your exciting, vital, interrogating works, and we would really love to read them.
In addition to not giving us a reason to put it down, also give us a reason to fight for it, because we do. Each one of us finds maybe strange, maybe odd, maybe atypical essays in the queue that we bring to the editorial meetings and go to bat for.
Mm-hmm. And we will have very long, very intentional conversations about these essays, and we will fight for them. We don't actually fight.
Yes, we do. No.
There's no fighting at Colorado Review, but we have these very intense conversations about pieces that we really love and want to see in the pages of the magazine.
Mm-hmm. Yes, all of us respond to work a little bit differently, and I think that's one of the fun parts about being at the Colorado Review, is that we get very passionately involved with the pieces that move us. And that comes through, too. I mean, I think when I say give us a reason to fight for your piece, you put yourself into your work, because someone's going to respond to it, and we will take it up the food chain on your behalf.
Mm-hmm. Stephanie and Harrison, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you,
Danny. It's been great.
As ever, we at the Colorado Review podcast want to extend our thanks to Stephanie Geschwind, editor-in-chief of Colorado Review and director of the Center for Literary Publishing, for making this podcast possible. Generous thanks also to Arne Geschwind, who provided the wonderful music that you heard during the episode. Thank you to everyone who joined us for this in-depth discussion with our creative nonfiction editors here at Colorado Review. In the coming months, you can expect to have similar conversations surrounding book reviews and poetry here at the Center for Literary Publishing. We hope you join us here again in November.